Today on Family Talk.
Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Meg Meeker coming to you from the International Christian Retail Show in Orlando, Florida. And today I'm joined by a former homicide detective. I love whodunits, but you did the real life, who's used his skills as an investigator to seek out the truth of the Gospels. I'm telling you, this man has a powerful story, and his book is intriguing and really fun to read. His name is J. Warner Wallace. He's a former L.A. County cold case homicide detective. Jim, thank you so much for being here.
Well, Meg, I already told you what a big fan we are, my wife and I, of your work. So
I'm
just
humbled.
Delighted to get the chance to sit with you.
Well, thank you. This is a fabulous conference. And as I told you before we started the air, I'm going to make a couple of my loved ones read your book. It's pretty, pretty cool. Tell us right out the chute, what's a cold case?
Well, you know, every other case of certain crimes, if it's robbery or burglary or any kind of thefts, these all have a statute of limitations. Those are things that if I don't catch the bad guy in the first 7 or 9 years, they're going to expire. I can't go back and do those cases. But murders never, there's no statute of limitations. They never expire. So if 30 years go by, 35 years, and my cases are all in that range.
Really?
Yeah, they're all old. I just did a case that was on Dateline about a month ago, and those cases are all in that 25 to 35 year range. That case was from 1979, and we arrested that guy in 2009. He bailed out immediately. Robert Shapiro was his attorney, and we waited another 5 years before we went to trial late last year. So I've been working these cases for years and years. I continue to consult with the LADA's office. I just feel like this is an important work. You got families out there who have been waiting for justice for years and years. And really had no hope, really. At some point, they lost hope.
And I imagine there aren't many detectives doing it.
Well,
and
wouldn't they think,
oh, come on, it's not solved by now, I'm going to give up, I'm done.
It's even worse in the political sense that these are cases that largely are forgotten. Mm-hmm. So even prosecutorial offices around the country don't want to dig up a case that everyone's forgotten about. There's no pressure to solve it. And now all you can do in a highly public trial, because these are all my cases ended up on Dateline. Mm-hmm. So these cases then get a high profile. So what, you might potentially lose? Why would I want to dig up a case that no one remembers and no one even cares about anymore to potentially lose this in a high profile public setting? So I think it's hard to convince. We have to have a case. And by the way, the reason why they're cold is because they are lousy. I mean, they're not great in terms of evidential. Mine are completely circumstantial. I build these cases cumulatively from a completely circumstantial cases. I've never lost.
Are these cases that you were involved with many, many years ago?
No. These are cases that a generation, like my dad's generation. My dad was also a police officer. My son is a police officer. We have three generations of law enforcement. But I can tell you that these are cases of my dad's generation, typically. Okay. And I've even looked at some of his unsolved to see if I could solve one from my dad.
Really?
I just haven't been able to do it. But I mean, these are cases that are some other set of investigators 30 years earlier. Now, here's the interesting thing about it. I have cases where I have a witness who was interviewed 30 years ago and has since passed away. And the guy who interviewed him 30 years ago has also passed away. So now I have a supplemental report taken by somebody who's dead about somebody who's dead. What does that sound like to you? Those are the Gospels. So that same approach you would take to determine what is true about that event 30 years ago, what is true about that report, you can actually apply to the Gospels, because it's an ancient event, no forensic evidence, no living eyewitnesses, but we can assemble a cumulative circumstantial case to determine if something is true.
How did you get involved in this?
Well, in cold cases,
yeah.
We just had about 30 that were unsolved back in like 1996. And we made a list of all the unsolved in our agency. And we thought, well, we assigned one case to each homicide guy on the team as a collateral duty. Well, eventually that was really tough to work them collaterally. You have to develop a full-time team. So a partner and I began that team for our agency, the first cold case team we'd ever had. And we began working exclusively just cold cases. And that gave us a much better chance of solving them, because mm-hmm. two guys were dedicated, plus one Los Angeles County criminalist, dedicated full time to just working cold cases. And we were able to, you know, put a bunch of them to bed. So that's how I got started. But as a Christian, you know, I'm kind of like, my story is similar to you. We both came to faith late, right? And I was 35. And my wife was somebody who was kind of like a cultural Catholic growing up, but really we never read a Bible, definitely not raised in a Christian environment. And so for me, I became interested in the Gospels as forensic witness statements. That's how I first started examining them.
Okay.
And applied all the stuff that we apply in cold cases.
Your mind intrigues me. Because somebody that goes from doing work that I would imagine is pretty gruesome, you probably see some pretty horrific things in LA.
Yes, yes.
And you're studying terrifically dark evil. And then to be looking at evidence and then make this sort of intellectual leap, wait a minute, I am looking at evidence that's either right or wrong, but I do find things that are right, and there's evidence and it's truth.
Right.
And when I apply it in this situation, I can come to a right conclusion. And you took that model of thinking and applied it to Christianity. Is that how you became a Christian?
Yeah, I was actually encouraged by the words of Jesus in Scripture. You know, I used to think of Christians, because all the Christians I knew, if you asked them, why are you a Christian? Even the cops I knew, who were like really devoted and devout observers of evidence, devout users of evidence. But if you asked them, why are you a Christian? They couldn't give me five good reasons for it. They couldn't give me any evidence. They weren't even aware what the evidence was.
And you were a young adult, in your early 30s-ish around then.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
And so for me, I thought, well, how could you be so concerned about evidence in your professional life, but you're so unconcerned about it in your spiritual life?
That's a great
question.
Just
bothered me. But I read Scripture, and I thought, well, for the first time, and I saw that Jesus would say things like in John 14, where he says, hey, if you don't believe what I'm telling you, at least believe the evidence of the miracles I worked in front of you. And then he spends 40 days with the disciples in Acts 1 after the resurrection, giving them many more convincing proofs. Also, I love the fact that when John the Baptist sends his disciples with doubt, you know, and they come to Jesus and they say, John's locked up, but, you know, he wants to know, are you the one? I'm thinking at that moment, Jesus could have scolded him pretty good, couldn't he? He could have said, hey, John's known me. He leapt in the womb when we first met. I mean, come on, he should know I'm God. He should know I'm who I said I was. But instead, Jesus works miracles in front of the disciples of John and says, go back and tell John what you just saw. Mm-hmm. So the idea that Jesus always made claims that were grounded in evidence that he first provided to his hearers.
Well, the whole Old and New Testament prophecy.
Absolutely.
Fulfillment of prophecy.
Absolutely.
It blows me away that people can't even just look at this, you know, hundreds of years span. You know, something was said here 900, 800 years ago that comes to fruition here. How could that happen but for God? I just want to go back. So you're working as a police detective in LA, and you're looking at all this evidence. What was it that was stirring you to find out real answers about Christianity?
You know,
did it just sort of come out of the blue?
Yeah, I wasn't really trying to disprove it or prove it. I just happened to walk into it. My wife would say, hey, let's go to church. And I'd been in this neighborhood about 3 years with her, and I had never attended church in that neighborhood. I was lucky. I thought, hey, I did pretty good. I even avoided Christmas and Easter for 3 years. But she said, I want to go. Let's go to church. And I was willing to go as an atheist. My dad has been doing that his entire life. He still does it.
Okay.
So I was more than willing to go as an atheist to appease my wife. But when I got to this particular church, the first evangelical church I'd ever walked into except for a wedding or a funeral, the pastor pitched Jesus as a smart ancient sage that had some things to say, important things to say. You should probably listen because they actually apply to your life. You know, you could become a better this or a better that if you listen to Jesus. So that's a very kind of, you know, seeker-sensitive kind of approach, right?
Yeah.
But for an atheist like me,
yeah,
who's not interested in Jesus as God, mm-hmm, I could be interested in Jesus as counselor,
mm-hmm,
as like Buddha as counselor,
yeah,
or like
to
Baha'u'llah.
To teach you how to live a good life.
Right.
Yeah, right.
No big deal. So I bought my first Bible. But as I'm reading to kind of mine out the words of Jesus to become like, you know, fortune cookie Jesus, I was kind of trying that approach. I realized that, wow, you know, these accounts have a texture that's very similar to multiple eyewitness accounts in the murders I'd worked or other crimes I'd worked.
So you're comparing Scripture with crime.
Yeah, absolutely.
With
witness accounts of crimes.
How
you know?
Cool is God?
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, this was what got me interested. And I thought, wow, there's some features here that I think I could test. You know, there's a template that we use when we test witnesses. So I thought I could use this template. And I was compelled to see if it would go the extra mile with me. Mm-hmm. So it took about 6 months of me really skeptically. We have a discipline called forensic statement analysis. I applied that to the Gospel of Mark.
So walk me through that. Because as you say, I'm looking for evidence. What is that, the forensic statement analysis?
Well, forensic statement analysis is simply a discipline we use to scrutinize words. The words. So I would typically, if you committed a crime, if I thought you committed a crime yesterday and I got you into custody today, I would give you a piece of paper with 24 lines on one side and an ink pen. And I would ask you to write down everything you did yesterday from the time you got up in the morning to the time you went to bed. Give giving you an ink pen. So you only have 24 lines. You got to stay on this side. So now you have to choose the kinds of words you're going to use because you only have one side of the page. And you're going to have to use ink. So if you make a change, I can see your change. So what I do is I start to actually analyze your use of pronouns, your use of tense,
really?
The kinds of
and
adjectives
and this works for anybody.
Verbs. Yeah, it does. And how you compress time or you expand time. You know, if you told me, hey, I drove from here to Sunset. But if you said, yeah, I drove over here to Sunset, but on Hollywood Boulevard, I hit a red light and I saw a car coming. Now you're using 100 words to describe a millisecond.
Right.
Why would you do that?
Right.
You know, or you've skipped a bunch of time and just skipped over it and compressed the time. So why would you do that? So these are the things we use. I thought, well, if I apply this to one of the Gospels, all I need is a Gospel in which I've got a claim about the Gospel that I could test. And Mark's Gospel, the earliest claim from Papias in the first century is that Mark is penning the account of Peter that Peter is giving to him in Rome.
Right.
He's scribing down, not necessarily in the right order, according to Papias, but definitely in accuracy, he thinks is top-notch. Okay, so I can now test something. Are Peter's fingerprints in Mark's Gospel?
Oh.
And that's what I use forensic statement analysis to do.
See, most of us can't do that.
Well, I think that you have to know enough about what is the claim about the Gospel. What disturbs me in the church, if I'm honest, we're in a difficult situation right now.
Very
hard. The culture
has
changed.
Very hard.
We've got to decide how we're going to respond to that. But here's what I see. And when students, especially in college, are in a crisis situation where they're being challenged maybe for the first time and they're considering walking away, the degree to which they know something is evidentially true is the degree to which they'll stay and stand firm. If they don't believe it, they just think, well, I've always kind of thought it was true, but that could just be my imagination. They'll walk away from this.
They'll walk away. And particularly, you know, they want to be scholarly. They want to think it through. They
That's
want
right.
the gospel. They want Christ as God's son to make sense.
Right.
And particularly because they're being taught that it doesn't make sense and it is a feeling. But what they don't see, many of them, because I work with a lot of these kids, is that they're being taught a very, very narrow view under the guise of being very open-minded.
Yeah, absolutely. Everyone has a worldview. The mistake to think is that we just have this kind of limiting worldview and the rest of the world is open to everything. No, they're not. The
right.
rest of the world holds a worldview of one nature or another too. The only question is which of these worldviews is actually comports with reality.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we have to kind of be able to help our students see. I have an illustration in the book. I talk about this. A guy I worked with who got involved in an officer-involved shooting, the suspect pulled the gun out on this guy before he could get his gun out. And he stood there facing the end of a gun of a suspect and realized that he's not going to get the first shot off. That guy is. Afterwards, he told me, I knew I was wearing my bulletproof vest. We all have to wear bulletproof vests. And we know those vests stop rounds because we've actually demonstrated that in the range. So we know the vest can stop rounds. So what he did, rather than run or drop to the floor or panic, is he said, I just decided to tense up my stomach muscles and take the first couple of rounds until I could return fire. So because he knew that the vest could stop rounds, he put his trust in the vest to do that. And if our students don't know that this
Terrifying.
Vest can stop
yes.
rounds, they're not going to trust it in a crisis.
Exactly.
So have we been shooting rounds at our vest in front of our kids? Have we been showing them what the alternatives are to Christianity and why they don't work? Have we been showing them that all the complaints against Christianity hit the vest and bounce off? If we don't do that with our students, then don't be surprised when they don't trust in it in a crisis.
Why don't we do it?
It's hard work, if I'm honest with you. I mean, honestly, why is it that there are so few professional top-level quarterbacks? Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of it's talent. But honestly, a lot of it is it takes a lot of work to get to that level.
Mm-hmm.
And this takes more work. This is not the easy version of Christianity, I'm suggesting. It's the hard one. Look, what if we could do this? What if we did a little mind experiment? What if we said that as far as Christianity goes, we are not going to any longer allow your expression of your faith to be Sunday attendance. We're going to abolish every Sunday a meeting. Now, if you want to be a Christian, you're going to have to express it some other way. I think what we've done is we've said, hey, the expression of Christianity is simply Sunday attendance. And if you show up on Sundays, you have now met your obligation
well.
To express your Christian
right.
beliefs.
Right.
But what if that was not an option for us? If we just instead had to engage the world somehow differently or do something other than just show up for an hour and a half meeting?
Mm-hmm.
What would it look like? What would we look like as Christians? Would there be any Christians? Or would we suddenly get off our behind and do something?
Mm-hmm. Well, we're not pressed. I mean, we're being silenced, but we're not pressed. But we're also being told lies about ourselves too. Where, I mean, we're branded as narrow-minded, too conservative, don't understand anything, unintellectual, non-thinkers, and this kind of thing. And we begin to believe that about ourselves. So let's go back to this cold case Christianity, because I want to know what you know about the scriptures and how you have applied your thought process, your training, to proving that there is evidence that Christ is the Son of God. How do you teach us that in cold case Christianity?
Well, part of it is just having a template by which you can evaluate if an eyewitness is reliable. Look, we have two accounts from Matthew and from John that claim to be direct eyewitness accounts of something that Matthew saw and something that John saw. Mm-hmm. Then Luke tells us in his first chapter that he spoke to all the people. He investigated the eyewitnesses, and here's what they said. And then you've got Mark, who allegedly, according to Papias, is writing about the eyewitness testimony of Peter. So in the end, we want to be able to test the testimony of these gospels. And there are four things we do to test eyewitnesses. I actually developed this from simply the jury instructions that we give jurors. We tell jurors that they can think about 14 questions in their mind when assessing eyewitness testimony on the stand. Those 14 questions boil down to four concepts. One, is the witness, was he really there? Do we have a good reason to believe the witness was really there? Two, have they been honest and accurate over time? Or have they changed their story over time?
What if they have memory issues?
Or three, can they be corroborated in some way so that some other piece of evidence comes in and corroborates their statement? And four, do they possess bias that would cause them to lie to us? Those are the four areas that we test eyewitnesses in. So I simply said, could we do that with the Gospels? You know, do we believe they're early? I do think they are early. I make a case for it in the book, from Scripture and from history of the first century. I think we can demonstrate that these Gospels are early.
Early as in?
As in early enough to have been written in the presence of other people who would have known if Jesus was really what they said he was. Because that's what's so important about early dating. The early dating of the Gospels is important because if they're written after all the people who knew Jesus were dead, well, you can say anything you want about Jesus.
Exactly.
And if they're written in the first century, within 20, 30 years of the actual events, like Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, there are still 500 people who saw Jesus resurrected all at one time, most of whom are still alive. If you don't believe me, go ask them.
Okay.
Well, you can only make that kind of a statement if all these documents are early enough to have been written when these people are still alive.
Right.
So that's why it's so important early dating. Second thing is, well, do they have changed? And we can actually measure any change in the Gospels. Here's how. If you think that this is all a legend, that the earliest version of Jesus was not supernatural, he wasn't born of a virgin, he didn't walk on water, he didn't rise, he's just a simple teaching rabbi.
No miracles.
And eventually we created the Christ from this simple figure named Jesus in the first century. That's something that I actually believed as an atheist, that I would accept that Jesus lived, but not the Jesus of the Bible, a simpler Jesus that was distorted over time. The problem, of course, is in any piece of evidence before a cold case, we can trace the chain of custody. I want to know who collected it. Who did he give it to? What did that person say about it? When he brought it to the crime lab, he wrote a report. What does that report say about what he received? Then they give it to me. I'll write a report. I can compare image after image after image of a piece of evidence over the years from its point of collection to the actual trial.
And this is what you do with Scripture.
Right.
But that you do.
So, for example, John's Gospel. What did John really say? Well, it turns out he had three personal students, Ignatius, Polycarp, and Papias. Mm-hmm. All became leaders in the church. But we have the writings of two of them. If you want to know what John taught, ask Ignatius and Polycarp, because they wrote letters to the local church that are not part of your scripture. They're part of church history.
So did you find those letters?
Yes. And if you see what does Jesus look like in those letters? Is he simpler or is he divine? Mm-hmm. Are all the attributes we see in the Gospels present immediately?
What did you find?
So I traced it from John to Ignatius and Polycarp, from there to Irenaeus, from there to Hippolytus. Do the same thing with Paul all the way through to Tatian. Do the same thing with Peter all the way through Mark, North Africa, all the way to Eusebius. If you do that, you'll get image after image of Jesus over time, and here's what you discover. They're all exactly the same. Jesus, born of a virgin, claimed to be God, worshipped as God, worked miracles as God, died on a cross, rose from the dead, ascended into heaven, seated at the right hand of the Father. You're stuck with the supernatural Jesus immediately, and he goes through that entire process of the chain of custody, never changes, never
morphs. This is so important. This is so important because I think so many Christians accept the truth of scriptures as sort of vague truth. And yeah, these things happened, but I am willing to admit that over time, as, you know, the story circulated in Aramaic or just talked to, that, you know, some things could have changed.
Right.
Because this is one of the things that I get from young people. Well, how do you know it's really accurate? Because so much time went by where it was orally circulated before it was written down.
Oh, well, okay, that's a great point. I want to just address that for a second. I get this all the time. I'll find a witness who was actually present 30 years ago and saw the crime. But guess what? Nobody found that witness 30 years ago, and nobody ever interviewed them.
Why?
So because they just didn't know they existed.
Okay.
They come forward now. They hear we're working the case. They see it on TV. They want to say, hey, I actually saw something too. So they come to me, and they give me a statement. Well, how do I know that the statement they're giving me today is an accurate reflection of what they saw? I'll say, hey, did you ever tell this to anybody else? Well, yeah, I told two of my friends. What are their names? I will go out and I'll interview those two friends to see if her story has changed in the 30 years. Do I care that it wasn't written down 30 years ago? No.
No.
I only care, is it true? Mm-hmm. Did it get to today uncorrupted? And that's the problem with any claim. Well, if you don't write it down immediately, why do you think they didn't write it down immediately? I'll tell you why I think they didn't write it down immediately. I think you see in the scriptures, the New Testament, over and over again, an expectation that Jesus would return before there'd be any need for a written scripture.
I agree.
The first martyrdoms occur in the early 40s when you've got like James, the brother of John. He's killed in Acts. He's killed in 44 AD. Well, guess what? When do you think you start to see scripture appear? In the 40s and 50s. Why? Because they clearly now think, hey, we're not going to get out of this alive. We better start writing this stuff down. This is not a plot to kind of wait for people to die so you can write this. They're writing it way too early if you're hoping. And by the way, even the most adamant skeptic like a Bart Ehrman will admit that the earliest writings about Jesus are the canonical gospels we have in our Bible. And he'll also admit that they emerge in the very region where the events actually occurred. So if you're going to do this lie, you either do it late in history or out of the region. If it's early in history in the region, that's much harder to tell a lie. Now, here's why we go through all this. In the end, I want my students to believe this is true on the basis of the evidence. Here's why. When push comes to shove, that kind of faith will survive. Right. I always tell people, I am not a Christian because it works for me. Because I'll be honest with you, it doesn't work for me.
Well, because what Christians are taught is just tell your story.
That's right.
Tell your story because your story is true to you, and people will know it's true to you, and then they will want a similar experience, so that's why they'll believe.
Okay, so
but for me, that was never good enough.
Right, and yeah. I can tell you, my own personal story is that my dad is an atheist, but he remarried in the 60s. His second wife is Mormon. I have six brothers and sisters raised Mormon. So when I first got interested in God, what do you think? How I got a knock at the door? My sister sent missionaries. So I did Mormon missionaries for 8 weeks. And I'll tell you something. I always say I became a Christian the same day.
So you challenged.
That's right. So I became a Christian the same day I became a not Mormon. And here's why this is important to me. In the end, when I ask Christians, why are you a Christian? Here's what I get. Number one answer, I was raised in the church. Number one answer. Number two answer, I've had an experience of some nature that has confirmed for me that this is true. Okay, great. Third reason, I've been transformed by what Jesus did in my life. Three great answers, but guess what? Those are also the Mormon answers. And that's the problem. Mm-hmm. Imagine, I'll give you a scenario. What if I told you that God came to me yesterday and in a vision and gave me three things to tell you, Meg, and I'm going to tell you those three things right now. How would you ever falsify my claim? You couldn't.
No.
Because you could say, no, he didn't. I could say, yes, he did. Now, if I told you instead that God came to me yesterday in human form and had lunch with me in my backyard with two of my friends and told me three things, and then he helped me dig my trench for my new irrigation line, and we built a treehouse together, well, now that's a claim you could actually test and falsify or verify, because you could ask my friends.
Right.
You could examine the ditch for divine elements. You know, you could see how cool
is the
treehouse. Yeah, exactly,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So now this is the kind of claim we have as Christians. We don't have a claim that has, say, just trust me. I had this, just trust me. We have a claim that can actually be examined because it's grounded in a historical event in the past.
Well, what a fascinating approach to proving the claims of the gospel. This type of solid apologetics is just what we need at a time when so many young adults are turning away from their faith because they don't know the evidence that supports the claims of Christianity. J. Warner Wallace's book, Cold Case Christianity, A Homicide Detective Investigates the Claims of Christianity, shows how Christianity stands up to the most rigorous scrutiny because it's the truth. He also has a website full of great resources for explaining and defending the faith. You'll find a link to it at drjamesdobson.org. Be sure to join us next time when I conclude my interview with J. Warner Wallace. We'll talk more about how parents can use these tools to equip their children to stand strong in their faith. This is Dr. Meg Meeker saying God bless and thank you for listening today. We'll see you again next time for another edition of Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk.
Family Talk is not associated with Focus on the Family.
Who doesn't want to be encouraged to make their marriage stronger? Our new Family Talk iPhone app is designed especially to uplift your marriage in a way that makes it easy for both husbands and wives to find great resources. The customized Family Talk app tailors content around where you are in life. Whether you're a husband, wife, dad, or mom, the Family Talk app will provide you with daily inspiration to strengthen your marriage and invest into the lives of your children. Go to drjamesdobson.org/app to download your free customized Family Talk app today.